Case number 21-2612, Kevin Lemke v. John Tomlinson et al., oral argument, 15 minutes per side. Mr. Ellison for the appellant.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Ellison.
Good morning, Your Honors. I apologize if we're speaking over. We have a slight delay here, but we should we'll work through our video this morning. I am Philip Ellison. I'm appearing on behalf of Mr. Lemke, and I've reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well.
Your Honors, the application of state rules of law by state courts in a manner alleged to restrict First Amendment freedoms constitutes state action. Our Supreme Court has said so on at least two prior occasions. One is the NAACP case, and of course the other is New York Times versus Sullivan. Where there's state action, there has to be a state actor. And where there's a state actor, that person or entity can be subject to suit under 1983 for alleged violations of the enforcement of the underlying law, if that underlying law violates the First Amendment. As the justices of the Supreme Court of Puerto Rico case provides, is somebody in that system has the institutional obligation to defend the constitutionality and the First Amendment constitutionality of those particular laws.
Counsel, let me ask you, could this constitutional challenge have been brought in the and the underlying action that you're challenging?
It was before my presence in the, I was part of the counsel underlying case. It could theoretically be, but it was the judge Tomlinson in that particular case said that all First Amendment issues were waived. So even if there was the ability to bring that action in state court, the 1983 is not required to be brought as a, the state court action or underlying state court matter is not required to be brought as a condition of exhaustion before being brought to federal court on a 1983 basis. And that's Monroe versus Papp and this circuit's case in Kanishevsky versus DHHS.
I guess I'm wondering why wait? Because if you brought it in the underlying action, you wouldn't have had to worry about whether or not the judge was adverse or not. Because you would have just had it in the original action to be litigated against his ex-wife.
Well, the difference here, Judge, is that these issues were not parsed out in the original first action case. For whatever reason, Judge Tomlinson deemed them waived. I don't know how you can waive a First Amendment constitutional issue that way. But the
action, and there was no appeal of Judge Tomlinson's order in the state court.
There is an appeal pending in the Michigan Court of Appeals. Yes.
Okay. So this issue is before the Michigan Court of Appeals. Also, the same issue you're raising in front of us.
It's a similar issue, but not exactly the same issue. This issue that's raised here is that the statute as it exists and is being applied by the state through state action, basically as I just outlined in the rule of NAACP. Is in fact unconstitutional on its face, and frankly as applied. So the issue, and frankly, even if the state court could adjudicate that particular issue, it does not matter under a 1983 jurisprudence. The federal courts do not defer or hold off on state court hold off because of state court proceedings in any way. There's no exhaustion requirement, and there's no wait till they get done requirement first before federal courts have jurisdiction. The problem that exists here is, and I was quite candid with the panel. I'm usually not quite that candid in my briefing where I say I can't discern a logical difference between kind of the two cases, being that the Third Circuit's been the leader in this, between Allen and Georgievich. I can't distinguish what constitutes a judge in one instance as being an adjudicator and in another instance being an enforcer. Now, in a typical case, the case would be easy because the plaintiff or at least one of the parties in that action would be an executive branch official, a sheriff, a prosecutor, a governor, an attorney general. And you could then bring an action and it's very common for to bring action to challenge a state law that's being applied in an unconstitutional or in a First Amendment violative way. We don't have that here.
Well, you don't have it because you haven't sued an executive official. You've sued a judicial official, right?
That is correct, because there is no executive official.
There is in Michigan. I mean, there's the Secretary of State. I mean, there's the governor. There's all sorts of executive officials. I mean, my question is, have you sued the right state actor for a 1983 action. I mean, by suing the judge, the judge really does adjudicate. Judge doesn't usually defend state laws. He adjudicates them. And that's not really his role of defending whatever the legislature passes and the governor signs.
I would point this court back to its McNeil decision that says you can't just simply pluck a state official from somewhere in the structure of government to be able to sue. They have to have some nexus to the action that's currently that you're challenging. Here, the governor didn't bring an action. The attorney general didn't bring an action under the
PPO. No, you brought the action.
Just to be clear, I'm talking about the underlying state action. The underlying state action was brought by a private individual. This somewhat mirrors, and I will be the first to say it, somewhat mirrors the whole women's health case. It's the same problem. The legislature has enacted a law that allows private parties to activate the machinery of the state.
But here isn't the judge. I mean, I don't see how there can be much disagreement that legislators pass laws and then judges apply them. And here the judge is simply applying, which is an adjudicative function. So how is there anything about this case that puts the judge outside of that traditional role that judges have, and that is to adjudicate by applying or interpreting laws?
So
it's a judicial function.
I would ask this court to separate the roles of a judge in a particular circuit. Let me back up, take a half step back. What makes this case unique from all others is that there's no executive branch official on the other side of the table in front of Judge Tomlinson at the time he makes rulings on any of these PPO cases. So there's nobody to sue, essentially. Now, the closest I could get was maybe we might have the sheriff who then effectuates under, for example, McNeil, seemed to provide some guidance, who effectuated the judge's order, maybe on the hook, may have that institutional obligation. But here, what I'm not challenging is what the judge adjudicated. What I'm challenging is the law that underlies that adjudication, the base law itself. And the only state official that has any responsibility for the enforcement of that statute is Judge Tomlinson. There is no prosecutor. There is nobody else. In the lower court, I quipped and queried out to the judges in both this case, and there's another similar case I have pending also in the Eastern District on this, is I've asked, who would I sue? Who would be the appropriate person to sue in this case? And nobody's been able to give me an answer, including myself, because the only person that has the nexus that's required under McNeil happens to be, in this case, a state court judge. So here, a state court judge is actually having two hats. He's the enforcer, and he's also an adjudicator. Now, I'm not challenging him as an adjudicator role. I'm challenging him as a state officer who's charged with enforcing a state law that exists.
But how can you separate his actions into that camp that you need in order to make this lawsuit a viable one? I understand your frustration, and you said there's nobody else to sue, but the fact that there's nobody else doesn't put the judge's actions, how does this put the judge's actions outside of those that are covered by judicial immunity?
So I would point, I guess the best answer, the cute answer would be carefully, right? More direct answer would be is I would use the example I used with the hypothetical I presented in the brief about the Asian American discriminatory case. You need to separate the role of the institutional role that a state official has in enforcing a law versus the role that the judge has in adjudicating the law. If I was challenging his adjudication in any way, I would agree. I would probably not have a basis to argue on that, but that's not specifically what I'm arguing here. What I'm arguing and have pled to the court is I'm challenging not the adjudication or his adjudication role. I'm challenging the law that exists underlying all of this. And I would point this court as kind of a guide, and it's a different doctrine, I will acknowledge, but it's a guide is the Skinner case. Skinner provides that kind of that separation that exists between those two. Now, Skinner wouldn't have had this problem because Skinner got to sue the prosecutor in that case. There was an executive branch official. for whatever reason, the legislature decided not to put in, give in, or to empower an executive branch official, but in fact empowered a private citizen. The only other solution that I could see to this is this court would have to either make an exception or a differentiation that a state who empowers a private individual to activate the machinery of the court that applies a law in an unconstitutional manner is in fact a state actor under 1983. Because otherwise, again, I kind of go back to what I was talking about.
Well, is it not possible that you could have a, is it possible to have a state constitutional violation without there being a state actor involved? I guess is my question.
I would be hard pressed to believe otherwise, because if there was no state actor enforcing a state law, we would have no standing. There would be no injury that would have ever occurred. Here we're alleging that this state statute that exists, it exists in an unconstitutional form because it causes essentially prior restraint. Is what I mean. That's the simple argument that underlies this. The problem that exists is who's responsible for enforcing this statute. And the only person that I can see that has any obligation, and here the judge here has essentially, I think when I was getting it a moment ago, has got two hats.
Well, the way government works isn't the executive branch the branch of government that does enforce the law? The legislature passes the laws, the judicial branch adjudicates the laws, but the executive branch is the branch that enforces law. Isn't that just basic government?
That is the problem.
Okay, so you're suing somebody who's in the wrong branch of the government.
But then I guess I would point to who would be the person from the executive
branch. Answering your questions. I mean, I'm determining whether you have alleged in your complaint adequate standing, I guess, for the federal court to get involved in this matter of whether the state law of Michigan violates the federal constitution.
I guess I would leave with this, my few seconds here, I would leave with this final point. If Judge Tomlinson is not the state actor that's there, you have essentially made this law unreviewable via 1983.
All right. And I think that may be the next case, but we decide cases that are before us. And I guess the issue here is whether Tomlinson is the appropriate state actor for this. You've got 3 minutes rebuttal. You could use it right now.
No, I've concluded. I will reserve my balance for a rebuttal. Thank you.
All right. Very good. All right. Let's hear for counsel for the appellees.
All right. Thank you. Good morning, Todd Schaude on behalf of Judge Tomlinson and Sheriff Matt King. I think it's very clear that a judge has no interest in the statute itself. The judge doesn't pass the statute. The judge's job is to adjudicate the statute and pass on the issue of whether or not the statute's enforceable and constitutional. I think the Sixth Circuit authority that we've had is, you know, supports that position. I think it's even more obvious now that the Supreme Court has ruled in Whole Woman's Life. They've made it very clear that you can't sue a judge who sits in an adjudicative capacity. And that's exactly what happened here. But this case is even worse, because this is a case where the judge issued a personal protection order that's not being challenged. What's being challenged is there was a claim that the PPO was violated. He then issued a decision where after he took evidence and he analyzed the law, he analyzed the Constitution, and he found that there were 7 claimed violations of the personal protection order. He found that 6 were protected by the Constitution and were not violations because they were protected by the Constitution. He found that one of those was not protected by the Constitution. So what we have here is not a challenge to a statute. We call it Mr. Ellison calls it a challenge to a statute, but it's really not. It's a challenge to a judicial decision on applying the Constitution. The judge reached a constitutional decision that he disagrees with. And then instead of using the traditional procedure of appealing that decision through the state court system, he wants to file an action in federal court under Section 1983, claiming that the judge's decision is unconstitutional, and therefore that makes the statute unconstitutional.
So I'm a little confused, counsel. Are you saying there is not a pending action in the Court of Appeals in the state that is addressing the ruling as far as the PPO being violated? Was there no appeal of that decision?
Yeah, I believe there was a recent appeal that was filed that was brought to my attention, but I'm not involved in that appeal, so I don't know what the details out of it. There is a state court appeal pending now, as I understand it. So that's the appropriate procedure. If you don't like a state court judge's ruling interpreting the Constitution, you appeal that through the state court system. The federal courts don't get involved unless it goes through the entire state court system, and then it goes on an appeal to the United States Supreme Court. That's the procedure that the court system has established for 200 years. Now, if you look at, Mr. Ellison keeps citing the NAACP case, that was an appeal that went through the Mississippi court system to the Mississippi Supreme Court, and then it was appealed from the Mississippi Supreme Court to the United States Supreme Court, not through a Section 1983 lawsuit in federal court. So what he's trying to do is upend the entire appeal procedure and say that, hey, if a judge in state court issues a decision and in Mr. Ellison's opinion, it violates the Constitution or misapplies the Constitution, therefore, I have a chance to appeal that in a Section 1983 case. That's not our federalism system. That's directly contrary to it. And judge, and then what he's doing here is he's filing an appeal without the parties to the underlying action being part of the case. And he's naming the judge as the defendant. So the judge then is put in a position where he's trying to make him an adverse party. Then he files motions in state court arguing that the judge should be disqualified because I'm suing him in federal court. So you get to appeal the decision without your true adverse party, the plaintiff in that case, his ex-girlfriend, even having a say in the case. I mean, it's just totally backwards, and it's something that this court should quickly reject, especially in this case. If this was a true challenge to just the statute, obviously the judge is not the proper party. That's clear. Now, if you look at the case against the sheriff's even more removed from this thing. So the sheriff's obligation under the statute is that when a PPO is entered by the court, the sheriff's job is to enter that PPO into the state lien system, the law enforcement information network. So then it's available to law enforcement in the field. That's his only role in this case. And the challenge is not to the PPO that was entered. The challenge is to the decision by the judge applying the law, concluding that there was a violation of a PPO. I mean, if you look at the thing, it's just, I mean, we have another level of absurdity because the judge specifically found that the statements, the one violation of the PPO was not constitutionally protected because it was speech to somebody and not about somebody. The lawsuit claims the exact opposite. I mean, and so you look at the sheriff, what is the sheriff's involvement? The order that he's challenged.
Before you go back to the sheriff, let me ask you a question. I know you'd moved from the judge to the sheriff, but then you went back to the judge. So let me just ask you, where do we draw the line between when a judge acts in a purely adjudicative capacity versus when the judge is an administrator or the enforcer of a statute? Is there some clearly delineated line that we can look to decide which side the judge's actions and conduct falls on?
Yeah, I think it's very clear. You know, when a judge takes the bench and has adverse parties who are litigating before them and then issues rulings based upon that, that's clearly an adjudicative capacity. That's clearly adjudicative. If a judge has some extra judicial role...
That describes Judge Tomlinson's conduct in this case.
Yeah, correct. I mean, that's exactly what he did. And that includes when a judge is acting based upon his own orders. If one of his orders is violated, he still has to sit as a judge and make a decision as to whether or not that order was violated. He takes evidence, he listens to the evidence, and then he applies that evidence to his order and the law and comes to a judicial decision. So all of those things are clearly within his judicial capacity, and he's acting as an adjudicator, not an adverse party. He does, just because he rules against somebody doesn't mean he's now their adverse party. He's still sitting as a judge. So I think it's very clear under Article 3 that there is no case or controversy against a judge when he's sitting in his role as a judge.
So how do you distinguish judicial counsel, how do you distinguish this case from the Georgievich v. Strauss case, that Third Circuit case?
Yeah, I think the lower court had it correct when they distinguished the two. In the Georgievich case, we were talking about a court sitting as a, I think it was a, was it a parole board, if I recall? Yeah, so the judge was sitting in a different capacity. They weren't adjudicating a issue between adverse parties. They were sitting in a role and deciding whether or not somebody was deserving of parole. They're actually basically acting the same as a parole board would in that case. And that's why the Third Circuit has distinguished that case. In the Allen case, they made it very clear. There's a big difference between a judge sitting in a domestic relations case where he's acting based upon orders. He's acting as an adjudicator, even if it's to enforce his own domestic relations orders, which is what we have in this case. So they made a clear distinction, and that, I think that distinction was well stated in that Allen Third Circuit case, which I cited to the court.
Thank you.
So yeah, I mean, if you look at the Georgievich case, the court struggled with it because there was a case against the parole board, and the judge was basically acting as a parole board. So how could you distinguish between the two was their point in the Georgievich case. But, getting back to Sheriff King, the complaint doesn't say he did anything or he was required to do anything. And the order that's being challenged doesn't require that he do anything. His only role in the PPO was to enter it into the lien system. Now, once Mr. Linke was sentenced on that, yes, he would be the jailer because he's required under state law to jail somebody as ordered by the court. But that decision wasn't challenged below, but it can't be challenged anyway because that would violate the Younger Abstention Doctrine and ask this court to get involved in criminal cases of local importance. So those would be barred anyway. The court wouldn't be allowed to get involved in that. And that's not specifically being challenged in this case anyway. If the court has any questions, I'd be happy to answer it.
I have none. Any further questions?
No.
Judge Donald, Judge Bush?
No. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal, 3 minutes rebuttal, Mr. Ellison.
Yes, thank you, Your Honors. Very briefly, Georgievich, I can't see a distinction with Georgievich. I know Mr. Shouty tried to just parse that out. The judge was still sitting as an adjudicator. He was adjudicating the issues involving whether a person's entitled to parole. So there's no distinction that can be made between Georgievich and Allen that I can see, because the judge, if the standard is, as Mr. Shouty argued to Judge Donald, is once he takes the bench, he's an adjudicator. He took the bench there. So, I mean, that's a distinction without a difference, and I can't see why that would make a difference between those two. There is no line there. This is that's the problem that exists with these style of cases. But what I would like to suggest would be is let's assume for the sake of argument today, you've disagreed with all of my arguments about Judge Tomlinson. Who would be the right person to bring in that respect? The U.S. Supreme Court just recently issued its whole women's health decision, which is a similar designed statute that provided a private individual to activate the machinery of the court to enforce issues involving abortion. The Supreme Court in that case held that while I will agree, 8 of the 9 justices agreed that in that particular setup, because of sovereign immunity, not Article 3, that the judges may not be the appropriate parties in that respect. The court there did hold that that enforcement officials, who themselves had taken no action against the doctors in that case, were parties that could be sued and get past the pleading stage. So even if this court disagrees with me about the judge, this court, the whole women's health would be instructing or at least telegraphing to this panel that a person in the in Sheriff King's role, even if he took no action, which here we just had a concession he did. He entered, he effectuated the unconstitutional statute by furthering it. That that would be an appropriate party who could have that, what we call the institutional obligation to defend. The only other ground.
So the only, the allegation against the sheriff is what? What did the sheriff do here that the you sheriff, say is state action?
The sheriff would have effectuated the court order that, and that court order was issued based on the underlying illegal unconstitutional law.
How did he effectuate it?
He took steps consistent with what the statute required, which was for him to record it into lien. Lien is a system in Michigan that is a statewide computer system that allows for enforcement of court's orders.
His act of recording it in a computer system is the constitutional violation?
Well, it would be the furtherance of an unconstitutional statute, which is, again, look at whole, I would encourage this panel, look at whole women's health. The U.S. Supreme Court said that that state actors, in that case, it would be the medical licensing professionals in whole women's health, even though they had taken no action in enforcing SB 8, that they in fact could be the appropriate persons to bring a 1983 action against.
Is a county sheriff a state actor?
In this instance, he would be, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right, anything further? Judges,
nothing further, Your Honors. I appreciate the time, and I'm not envious of the work you've got to do with this. So.
All right. Thank you for your argument. Cases submitted. You may call the next case.
All right. Thank you.